Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio to focus on the future. I'm really excited today to have an incredible guest with me, one of the most profound thinkers that I know, Stephen M. Rosen. Let me give you a little bit of background on Steve, and then we'll hear from him directly. So, Stephen is a professor emeritus of psychology at the College of Staten Island of the City University of New York, and he began exploring the foundations, frontiers, and poetics of science, and his work became transdisciplinary and philosophical in nature. And indeed, one of the things that I absolutely love about Steve's work is that he questions the assumption that many people don't even bother to recognize as assumptions. And in questioning them, comes up with just some profound, profound insights. So he's here to share some of them with us today. So welcome, Steve. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, so I suspect that not many of our listeners are familiar with you or your work, unless you have broadcast this to your former students from your college professor years.
Well, I probably have a few cronies out there. Camped by their phones.
So, yeah, great. Even though, you know, you have a recent book out called Dreams, Death, Rebirth, A Topological Odyssey into Alchemy's Hidden Dimensions, I think in order to, like, really fully grasp where this gets us to, this particular book, we need to look at and become familiar with your previous works, because there is definitely a building up over the years. And on the website for the show, you can see the covers to some of the previous books. In particular, we can start with Dimensions of Apeiron, and then the next book is called Topologies of the Flesh. And after that came the Self-Evolving Cosmos. So can you lead us through the ideas throughout those books that have led to the current one? I know we can't get into all the wonderful details in them, but just give us a lay of the land, so to speak.
Well, I don't think I can get into all of the details either, but I can say that three of my last four books, including the present one that we're going to be talking about in the most focused way, are designed along the lines of alchemy. And so I probably should say a little bit about alchemy. It isn't,
right.
People think of alchemy conventionally as an absurd flirtation with turning matter into gold, a sort of money-making process. But alchemy actually involved a transformation of consciousness and its relation to matter. Jung, C.G. Jung, took alchemy very seriously. Worked on it for years, wrote three books, at least three dedicated books on alchemy. And what Jung implies is that the goal of alchemy is the transformation of consciousness, refining consciousness, making it into a living reality. And one way to look at it is that this is geared toward achieving a wholeness of mind and matter, this alchemical project. The basic motto of alchemy is solve et coagula, dissolve and coagulate. So in the first part of the alchemical procedure, called the solutio, the part involving dissolving, the substance is divided into separate parts so it could be refined, and then in the next phase, it's coagulated, brought back together again in a refined form. So if you apply this to mind and matter, first they're separated, so you can get beyond the early stage in which mind and matter were confused with each other. And then after that, there is the coagulatio. Mind and matter are consolidated, brought back together in a concrete realization of wholeness. So this is what I was thinking as far back as the first book you mentioned, and I'm sure before that. Dimensions of Apeiron was designed along the lines of dissolve and coagulate. And then Topologies of the Flesh was next. That brings you back to 2006. And I wrote abstractly about wholeness in that book and about alchemy. Toward the end of the book, I was looking for a way to take my abstract words and make them into a living reality, a kind of living flesh. I was taking my lead in part from Jung, who spoke of the need, quote, to make our paradoxical wholeness a concrete reality. This is a process of self-realization. Jungians call it individuation. So my question, at the end of that book, Topologies of the Flesh, and after I finished that book, was, how do I do this? How do I make my words more tangible as part of the alchemical process of coagulating them, making them into a living reality? Writing about wholeness in the conventional way no longer seemed adequate to me. So I experimented. I set up a website where I could go beyond printed words using sound effects, videos, and the like. I did a multimedia ebook where I pursued the same idea. But those projects didn't really help me get my work out into the world the way a conventional print book could. And what I ultimately found is that I could, in fact, move toward this alchemical goal of fleshing out the text by developing a conventional print book in an unconventional way, as a blending of abstract concepts and concrete experience enhanced by my own dreams and by vivid images, including many alchemical illustrations, photographs, and original drawings that really have great personal significance for me. And this is what you have in Dreams, Death, Rebirth. So we've, you know, we've threaded our way back to what we're focusing on today.
Yeah. It is a very different kind of, philosophical, psychological work, in that the reader feels your presence more than in just an abstract philosophical work on the nature of, you know, whatever, being, thinking, justice.
Yeah.
Really bringing together the subjective and the objective by bringing yourself into this book as a real king being. It's not just your abstract thoughts being presented here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's very important to me. And I see it as part of you know, this alchemical project. Yeah.
Yeah. And if we can start that in philosophy, you know, who knows, maybe we can extend it to science, too. Or, you know, science is going that way in its own way of acknowledging the effect of the experimenter on the experiment, the effect of subjectivity on our objective supposedly objective reality.
Absolutely important to get it into science, Lisa. And the self-evolving cosmos, the book I didn't mention, focuses on physics and with just that aim in mind of finding a way of working in the subjective dimension.
Yeah, and it does it in a really beautiful way. I'd like to just highlight a little bit about that book, too, because you do something that I've never seen anybody else do, which is you look at the genesis of dimensions themselves. You know, we kind of take this three-dimensional world for granted without looking deeply into, you know, what is a dimension and what are these so-called lower dimensions, the two-dimensional, the one-dimensional, and the zero-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
And you do a really lovely job at looking at some of those assumptions that we have about our
dimensions. And I try to bring in those dimensions I consider to be psychophysical. They're not just physical, the way I look at them, but they're blendings of psyche and the physical, psyche and physis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's extremely important in terms of dealing with the problems in physics, because physicists just, you know, despite the inherent connection between the observer and the observed in quantum mechanics, physicists just can't bring themselves to incorporate the observer, the subject, the psyche, in a legitimate way, in a genuine way. So that work has to be done in physics, and I'm sort of pushing in my own way toward that.
Yeah, so you introduce a philosophical concept, depth. And you say a way to do that is the depth dimension. Can you just talk a little bit about that before we go on?
Sure. Yes. The depth dimension does play a big role in the self-evolving cosmos. And it is based on the thinking of the French phenomenological philosopher Maurice Merleau-Ponty, who did precisely what I'm talking about. He was critical of conventional physics and the conventional idea of space and of dimension. And for him, the notion of depth, of the depth dimension, is a way of surpassing the objectifying dimensions of conventional science and bringing out that in this deep, deeply embodied depth dimension, subject and object flow together in a completely seamless way. And in my book, I introduce the readers to phenomenological philosophy and to Merleau-Ponty's idea of depth.
Yeah. So I just wanted to bring that out because we might be circling back around to it a little later on.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important concept. Why don't we move on to your new book now, Dreams, Death, Rebirth, A Topological Odyssey into Alchemy's Hidden Dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
The dimensionality that we were talking about, you know, from your previous book, I think, is, I wanted to bring it up because those are the dimensions that you bring back in this book.
Yes.
And
they're psychophysical dimensions, as I say, in this book. They're not just, you know, physical or objective dimensions.
Mm-hmm. So you have some potent words in the title, Dreams, Rebirth. Shall we just start with dreams and tell us about the role of dreams in this book in your life, however you'd like to go.
Well, I could talk about my dream journal. And actually, in this book, there are dream journals at the end of many of the chapters. So I sort of thread my dreams through the book. According to James Hillman, the archetypal psychologist James Hillman, there's a very close relationship between dreams and death. According to Hillman, dreams involve, when you're dreaming, you're descending into the underworld. So in looking to explore the subject of death in a personal, tangible way, working with my dreams was a great help. Generally, the dreams in the book play the role of a kind of Greek chorus echoing from my unconscious, mirroring the more abstract themes of the book in a more concrete way. Shall I say any more about the other elements of the title?
Please
Death
do.
Again, this is an alchemical book, a book really on alchemy, and in alchemy, death and rebirth, the possibility of rebirth, are very important themes. And we might say that death and rebirth, that is the question for all of us, even though it remains in the background for those of us who are not practicing alchemists. So dreams, death, rebirth. The only word we have not yet accounted for in the title is topological. Should I say something about that?
Yes, please do.
All right. Conventionally, topology is a branch of mathematics that studies the properties of geometric figures. Figures that stay the same when they are stretched or deformed. But in the book, I use topology in quite an unconventional way. There are mysterious, paradoxical forms in topology, like the Möbius strip and the Klein bottle, that unite inner and outer and that are strangely reminiscent of alchemical forms. So what I do in the book is use these topological figures to flesh out the structures of alchemy, giving them greater, these topological figures give them greater vividness and imaginal precision. So they spark topological imagination, makes everything more vivid, and helps to bring the whole picture into focus.
Yeah, so since we don't have pictures of these things up on the website, I'd invite people to just do a quick search. Möbius is spelled M-O-B-I-U-S, or sometimes M-O-E-B-I-U-S. And you can search for Möbius strip or Möbius surface. And then Klein, K-L-E-I-N, bottle or Klein surface. And you'll see the paradoxical nature of these. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how they're paradoxical and how that paradox serves the ideas that you're working with in this book?
Well, you know, one thing I could say is that 20 years ago, I published a paper showing the remarkable resemblance of the vessel that alchemists use, the mysterious vessel, the hermetic vessel, the resemblance of that vessel to the Klein bottle. The Möbius strip and the Klein bottle are structures that unite inside and outside. You go along a Möbius strip, and you think you're going along on the outside, and before you know it, you're on the inside. So inside and outside on the Möbius strip and the Klein bottle flow together If you take it as symbolic of the way mind and matter, or psyche and matter, flow together in Jung's thinking and in alchemical thinking, you can see why those vivid images of a surface flowing into itself, paradoxically, relate to the subject of alchemy.
Yeah, yeah, I think they're beautiful examples of the paradoxical nature of subject and object or mind and matter.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And in fact, that's what initially brought us together.
Yeah, that's right.
Our interest in these interesting topological structures.
Yeah, I mean, they take you beyond words of paradox into a kind of graphic embodiment of paradox that brings it home so much more, you know, so much more tangibly than just saying the words paradox or, you know, doing it just verbally.
Yeah. So let's loop back to death and identity. You discuss death in relation to identity, not in its usual opposition with life,
mm-hmm.
which is very interesting. So what is the significance of death, or perhaps what kind of death are you referring to here when you talk about it this way?
All right, well, let me say a little bit about the connection between identity and death. Identity plays a really pivotal role in the book because the meaning that death has for us depends on our sense of who and what we are and on the boundaries and limits of what we take to be our being. You know, for the past several hundred years, Western culture has assumed that human identity is limited to a localized center of consciousness that inhabits a discrete body during life. Then when death comes, this individual consciousness either transcends the body, according to the religious believer, or consciousness is simply extinguished, according to the skeptic. But this way of thinking about identity is actually not much more than 600 or 700 years old. In earlier times, people experienced their identity as intimately entwined in communal life, so that when a member of the community perished, no one doubted that that member survived by virtue of being intimately bound up in the community. This is an important theme in the book. How has human identity been transformed over the centuries, and what does this mean for beliefs and attitudes about death? And we could be talking about physical death, of course, but psychological death, symbolic death, they come into the picture as well.
And the boundaries that you mentioned. So it seems like modern people have adopted a rather limited boundedness, you know, like I am my body kind of boundary.
Yeah.
And it seems that you're trying to expand that boundedness in a way.
Yeah,
correct?
Well, I mean, that boundedness, that constraining boundedness, again, is just about 600 or 700 years old in the human psyche. And before then, the boundary was expanded. You know, there was no sharp division between one, you know, biological unit and a separate biological unit. There was a flowing I could say transpermeation, a flowing entwinement of individuals in something far more holistic. But it was undifferentiated. So it could be said that we needed to develop sharper boundaries. And having done that, having lost our communal connection with each other, I think the task is now to rediscover that earlier sense of community communality, to rediscover it without sacrificing the discrimination that we've developed in the interim, so that things don't just regress into an amorphous soup.
Right, and right. So the amorphous soup we started with has been undergoing this process of solutio, of being distinguished and differentiated, and we separate animal, vegetable, and mineral, and within animals we have, you know, kingdoms and phylums and genera and species and so on and so forth. We've done a really good job at the separatio. And so it seems now you're saying, okay, it's time to flow back into coagulatio, but not coagulatio into the same undifferentiated whatever, that soup that we started with.
Yeah,
but
that's beautifully summarized. Yes.
A different kind of coagulatio that preserves the distinctions without, how would you say this?
Well, that as the wholeness is concretely realized without losing the distinctions. And that's what, you know, Lisa, you and I have both been very interested in paradox. And that's the paradox, that in the coagulatio, we have a wholeness, a oneness that is at the very same time a multiplicity, a two-ness or a multiplicity. So I am you and I am I, and both are true, and it's terribly paradoxical because in our either-or thinking, we want to say, well, either we're separate or we're one, but how can it be both? And that's where thinking and speaking, I suggest, need to change so as to accept that paradoxical possibility of being distinct and at the same time being each other, being the planet and being distinct from the planet.
So in the book, you get into discussing the various layerings, shall we say, of the wholeness, particularly the way they were distinguished in alchemy, which is anima, vegeta, and minera. Can you speak some more about the significance of these, particularly, you know, in the whole context of, that we've just kind of set up in terms of solutio and coagulatio and paradox and...
And death and rebirth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can think of all of that in terms of layers or dimensions of the psyche, each of which is aligned with a different layer of nature. So there's the dimension of the human intellect, but also a deeper layer of feeling aligned with the animal world. Then there's a layer of sensuality linked to the vegetable world and a layer of intuition associated with the mineral. That's how it, you know, it presents itself to me and how it's presented in the book. In the book, I describe a four-stage process of self-realization in which each stage engages a different layer of consciousness, with each entailing its own kind of alchemical or shamanic crisis, its own form of death and rebirth. So, for example, in the first stage of individuation, the first conjunctio, as Jung described it, a conjunctio or conjunction, in that first stage, there's a crisis of the intellect. Here, the rational human mind is confronted with absolute paradox and challenged to embrace paradoxical wholeness so it can achieve an unio mentalis, again, the Latin term, a unified mind. If it can do this, the mind will survive its demise as a merely rational being, and it will be reborn as transrational, being able to accept paradox. In the next stage, the feeling part of us that's aligned with the animal world falls into crisis, and we're flooded with tumultuous emotions threatening to engulf us unless we find a way of containing those feelings. And the containers are topological containers. They're paradoxical containers. So the pattern here is pretty intricate and laid out in the book in detail, but I hope you can see where I'm going with this, where I went with this.
Yeah, so there's a rebirth at each of these different phases or different facets of consciousness.
Part of consciousness dies and then is reborn if the crisis can be dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
So that's the journey we're talking about, going on this journey of dying to the old limited way and being reborn in a transformed way on many different layers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they might not happen, you know, sort of one right after the other. You know, you learn to crawl, and then you learn to walk, and then you learn to run. Does it happen in that kind of structured
way? Well, some of them are deeper
way?
And harder to act. Some of the layers are deeper and harder to access than the others. You know, it's... If we're talking about a really concrete dimension of human being, something down in the guts, that's harder to get to and harder to change than would a transformation of the intellectual level be. So in other words, I could understand the need for change intellectually. I do understand the need for change intellectually, Lisa. But when it comes to getting it down to those deeper layers, into my feeling, into my sensuality, into my guts, it becomes harder. So that suggests a kind of sequence. The easier ones come first and serve as guides for the more difficult, the more deeply ingrained, the more deeply embedded, the lower, you know, sediments in the structure of my psyche. And it's an ongoing process, and I'm continually amazed at how I can understand something intellectually and getting it down into my body where the habits are more deeply embedded and entrenched. That's another story, and it's an ongoing process for me and maybe for other people as well.
And one of the, let's just say, tools that you introduce to do this is a term called proprioception. Could you tell us a little more about proprioception?
Yeah. You can contrast ordinary perception with what I call proprioception. In ordinary perception, there's a projection outward, away from yourself, out into the world of external affairs. But the time comes in life, Jung put it in the second half of life around the age of 40, when we're called on to draw back in on ourselves, examining our motives and complexes, unearthing the subterranean workings of our psyches. In this backward or retrograde movement, we withdraw projections into the world and trace them backward into their unconscious origins. In so gaining consciousness of these underlying processes, we're engaging in proprioception. The term originates from physiology, where it refers to the sense we can have of the action of our own muscles and tendons and joints. Etymologically, the word proprioception derives from the Latin proprius, meaning one's own, and capire, to take. So proprioception is literally a self-taking. But along with physicist David Bohm, I use the term in a broader sense than the physiological. In this context, what I mean by proprioception is an act of moving back into ourselves to take ourselves in as a whole, including the unconscious roots of conscious experience. It's a switching of gears that puts us into reverse, and I take this as a crucial step in the process of self-realization, or again, to use the Jungian term, individuation. So that's why I've quite taken with the term proprioception, and it appears quite a lot in the book and in earlier books as well.
So is it like meditation, or is it like and unlike meditation? Where
I would say that it is a kind of meditation, not sort of a classical Hindu or Buddhist approach to meditation, although those are very valuable. But in the case of proprioception, there's more of an aspect that brings us back into the body. So it isn't so much a movement of the mind away from the body as it is a movement back down into the body, and a bringing of consciousness to the unconscious substrate of the body. And you can say it's a meditation in that sense, yeah. I mean, it isn't the ordinary way we think. We think projectively. We push our thoughts out there, and here the thoughts are coming back in and back into the body.
So it's a kind of observing what's going on inside, kind of an imaginative observing. Or
yeah, and
like,
you know,
Gene Gendlin calls a felt sense.
Exactly, exactly. Gene Gendlin's idea of the felt, of getting a felt sense of what's happening in one's body, is a good example of what I'm talking about, and could also be practiced in human relations in a process known as dialogue. In the sense of, in the way David Bohm used the term dialogue, there are dialogue groups. And I've referred to it on my website as proprioceptive dialogue. We're talking to each other, we're trying to relate to each other, but we're not throwing ideas at each other and, you know, holding to a fixed stance. What we're doing is, as we're trying to relate to each other, we're moving back into our own bodies. We're aware of our own processes as we're trying to relate. So if I were practicing dialogue with you now, I'd be aware of perhaps my feeling of wanting to perform well in this interview and impress the audience. I'd be aware of this on a gut level, on a bodily level, and I'd relate to you on the basis of that awareness, and that awareness would be brought into the exchange. So this is a kind of, if it's done in a group, it's a kind of group meditation that is proprioceptive. And again, it's another way of realizing the alchemical goal of deep embodiment, of coagulation, of, you know, getting down to the flesh, of fleshing things out and coming down from our abstractions that have gotten us into such disastrous, you know, disastrous problems in recent times.
Yeah, so you just showed us a way to do that, And so I went into myself and noticed that, you know, my anxiety about this interview going well shows up as a shallow breathing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I'm hardly breathing here.
I'm taking a deep breath as you're talking.
Yeah, and just think if people conducting really important negotiations, like, you know, scaling back on nuclear arms or trade agreements or ending wars, could come to this, use this kind of self-awareness during the proprioceptive dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So that brings up a question about, how this work might make its way back or way out into the world. It's obviously very profound and useful work, but not, you know, sit on the beach and page-turner type reading. You do have to engage with it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Deeply. And our society these days can be so superficial and wants it in, you know, 10 easy steps or a 2-minute YouTube video. If we could put ourselves into the future 50 years from now and go, wow, you know, Steve Rosen's work really had a profound influence on life on Earth, how might that happen? I mean, starting with our little conversation here. Who knows?
Yeah, I
or
think,
maybe a different way of asking this question. Sorry to interrupt. But another way to ask this might be, what kind of effect on world life would you like for your work to have?
Well, I'd hope that I would contribute something to what we're saying, to realizing a more harmonious, organically interconnected world where people are no longer cut off from each other and objectifying each other with totally disastrous consequences, but people can relate to each other and to nature in a more intimate and communally embodied way. And I think this could actually lead to a step in evolution even, and I've written about that. But I really don't know how much time we have to switch gears and begin relating to each other in proprioceptive dialogue or in a more intimate way. I think if we wait 50 years, it may be too late. Yet, for me, the point is not to devote a whole lot of energy to being pessimistic or optimistic about the future, but to do all I can in the present moment by way of realizing this proprioceptive wholeness in myself and in my own relationships. We're dealing with such deeply entrenched habits that it is a huge challenge. And I could say I'm pessimistic, or I could say I'm optimistic. But again, I don't really want to say either. I just want to get down to work as best I can and, you know, and let the chips fall where they may. So I can say is that even though things are quite difficult right now, the more difficult they become, the more obvious it is that the usual way of dealing with each other and with the world isn't working. And when it becomes obvious that that's the case, people may start to be ready for other alternatives. You know, if things are working fine, then why should we change? But if things are on the brink of catastrophe, we better damn well change and try something very different, something new. And so that, you know, that could possibly contribute to a willingness, a readiness to switch gears into this other mode of relating.
Yeah, and starting with ourselves, finding that wholeness with ourselves, which leads us through the semi-permeable boundaries, through the paradox, to the wholeness with the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's very true.
So that is indeed profound work to be doing, to be looking at the present as being, now let me say that again, looking at the future as being constructed moment by moment from the present. It's not, it's not something out there, but we're making our future with each breath, with each choice, with each solutio and coagulatio that we engage in.
Yep. And, you know, just it's really hard because there's such an irresistible tendency to deal with the whole thing abstractly. And it's so difficult for me to see my own foibles on a deeper level, on an embodied level, and you know, and accept them. So a lot of body work is involved here of that kind, of attunement to how I'm functioning, to my own process. So if I'm feeling irritated, or if I'm feeling dismissive, if I'm if I'm relating to my wife as a child would relate to a mother, and all of those resentments that can come up, I have to be aware of all that and process that. Not easy. Not easy. But that's the immediate challenge, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, of being both in it and aware of it at the same time.
Absolutely.
And being able to make different choices based on the awareness. You know, when you can see that, oh, I'm relating to my wife as a child, you can stop and say, okay, change that and relate as an adult now.
Yeah, it becomes diffused. You might not be able to stop completely. I'm reminded of the film A Beautiful Mind. Do you remember that film?
Yeah.
Where this brilliant mathematical economist.
Yeah, John Nash.
John Nash has to deal with a psychosis where he's hallucinating figures, nefarious figures. He's seeing them. They aren't there, but he sees them. And his way of dealing eventually with these figures is, he says, oh yeah, there they are again. I know. I'm still seeing them, but I know what they are. I've projected them out there. So what I'm saying is, just being aware of my, let's say, my resentment toward a mother figure doesn't make the resentment disappear, but I can say, oh, there it is again. And it sort of loses its power over me to a certain extent, and I have to keep on doing it because that tendency, that mother complex is so strong. I have to keep on proprioceiving that tendency, getting in touch with it, getting a feel for how it operates within my own psyche. And it can fade eventually. Hard work, but necessary work, and got to stick with it.
Yeah, and the layers that you describe in doing that. So there's the first, mental awareness, oh, that's what I'm doing, which you can then go deeper into, well, how am I feeling when this happens? And then you start to understand that, you know, this happens whenever, let's just make something up here, whenever you feel insecure about something.
Sure.
And then you can go deeper and go, okay, well, where is that happening in my body? Oh, I have this pain on the right side of my lower back.
Or yep.
Wherever. And then you can go and actually, you know, do the either body work or the proprioception and feel the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Invite it up.
Yeah. That's it. That's you describe it well.
Yeah, I just had to do it.
Okay. I missed what you said.
So, this has been really, really rich. Is there anything else you want to bring up? Any important ideas you want to talk about from this book or any of your other books before we have to say goodbye?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground, and there's a lot of, I hope, there's a lot of food for thought and food for feeling and food for sensing and what we've said. So I'm content. I'm happy.
Okay. Well, why don't we let readers know about your website, which is embodyingcyberspace.com.
Yes, embodyingcyberspace.com.
And your books are all available on Amazon.
Mm-hmm,
they're
yep.
Stephen with a V, M. Rosen, R-O-S-E-N.
Yep.
And you have a number of papers online, too. Is there a central...
Well, you know, you can plug in to many of them. If you go to my website, there's a link to books and a link to articles. If you were interested in the individual papers, you could click on articles, and many of them would come up when you did that.
Yeah. So if you want to take a small step into Steve's work before diving into these profound books, that's a good way to start, and they're online. And like I said, Steve is one of the most profound thinkers that I know these days, and I'm honored to know him and honored to have him as a guest on the show.
And I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, I think since we feel like we've reached completion, there really isn't a need to, say, stretch it out for another 5 minutes, which we have left, but to just be complete and say thank you. I am very grateful to have had this conversation with you. And
thank you. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
My pleasure. And next time you have another book coming out, maybe we can have another chat like this.
Far into the future. No, we can have another chat, but we shouldn't hold our breath for the next book. They take a long time.
Well, great, Steve. Thanks again. And,
okay, Lisa. Take care.
You too.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.